All right, welcome to another episode of Mazel Tov Cocktail, a Jewish left podcast from the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, Melbourne. It's conversations with me, Max Kaiser, and interesting people in Australia and internationally. We have a great show for you today with my good friend and comrade Geordie Silverstein joining us. Geordie is an activist with the Australian Jewish Democratic Society and a historian at the University of Melbourne. We talk multiculturalism, its limits and potentials, Aboriginal sovereignty, Holocaust narratives, Zionism, and more. The framing device for this discussion is the government's attempt to weaken the Racial Discrimination Act. We'll go more into detail about this policy in the interview, but for now I just want to note that we recorded this interview a couple of days after the government's policy changes were announced. And since then, of course, the proposed changes have been defeated in the Senate. It being an obsession of the right in this country, though, I doubt we've seen the last of this debate, unfortunately. The other thing I just wanted to note is there's some noise of planes flying overhead in the first half of the interview. But apart from that, let's get into it. All right, Geordie, thanks so much for joining us on Mazel Tov Cocktail. We're very happy to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Max. Such a great podcast.
Yay, thank you. So could you just to get us started, would you be able to introduce yourself a little bit?
Sure. So I'm Geordie Silverstein and I do quite a few different things, but I guess for our purposes, the two main things I do is that I'm a historian based at the University of Melbourne. And I've done research looking at Holocaust memory and histories of modern Australian and US Jewish identity and those kinds of things. And I'm also a member of the executive of the Australian Jewish Democratic Society.
Great. Okay. So one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on the show, Geordie, was you wrote a very impassioned Facebook post recently that was about the government's planned changes to Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act. Now, I know that sounds like very sort of legalistic and obscure, so I was hoping that particularly for our overseas listeners who may not be familiar with this debate, can you tell us a bit about what this 18C thing is? And, yeah, what's sort of been the history of it? Why has it become such a big focus of debate in Australian politics?
Sure. So Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act basically gives people the ability to bring sort of a case and take it to the Human Rights Commission if they face racial discrimination. And the This act has always come under attack from the right. So I think interestingly, the two main groups who have used this act, this Section 18C, have been Jews and Aboriginal people. So I think that's a really interesting point. So 18D provides a series of exemptions. So if anything is said or done reasonably in good faith for artistic work in the course of making a statement or a publication or genuine, you know, academic, artistic or scientific purpose, if there's a genuine purpose in the public interest, if it's a fair and accurate report of an event or a matter of public interest or a fair comment. So there's all these exemptions to 18D, that 18D provides to 18C. So 18C is really about, you know, racism and these things that do kind of occur on these kind of everyday bases. Of course they do. So what normally happens is, you know, it goes to mediation, and it's only if mediation fails that it would then go to the court. It's incredibly rare for a claim under 18C to go to the courts. So I think those things are really key, right? That this is what we're talking about is really serious breaches of the Racial Discrimination Act that end up being unable to be unmediated through conversation and need to be dealt with by the courts.
Mm. So you mentioned before about how the major cases have involved Jews and Aboriginal people.
Yeah.
Probably the most famous case was the Andrew Bolt case.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? And it particularly seems like that after that case was successful, that's really when the conservative side of politics in Australia really doubled down on wanting to get rid of this provision or alter the law.
Exactly. So the Andrew Bolt case was in 2011, and what happened was Bolt was found by the courts, by Justice Morty Bromberg, to have breached 18C. What had happened is there were 9 Aboriginal applicants, and they brought a suit against Bolt and the Herald Sun, which is where he publishes, saying that he had offended, insulted, humiliated, intimidated them. His articles had been about saying that these Aboriginal people who he had determined were not sufficiently black, and he determined, Bolt had written that they had used their Aboriginality for professional gain. And it was incredibly offensive language and of course, highly inaccurate. And this is why, it succeeded. It was the articles that Bolt wrote then, as pretty much all articles Bolt writes, are intended deliberately to offend, insult, humiliate the people who he's writing about. So ever since then, Andrew Bolt is this kind of really key figure in the right in Australia, particularly in Victoria.
Mm.
And so the right really picked it up, the issue up after that, and made a ongoing campaign that 18C should be overhauled and should be weakened and lessened. And so that also came up again with Bill Leake. So really these changes, and, who's an incredibly racist, was an incredibly racist cartoonist who died the other week. But all of these, as people have been pointing out online, all of these new changes to 18C that are being proposed are about helping white people and helping white people be more offensive. So the changes that have now been proposed, that Turnbull announced the other day, was to retain the word intimidate for the base within the language, but remove insult, offend, and humiliate and replace it with harass. And so in that way to weaken 18C and to weaken the idea of what the Racial Discrimination Act is meant to protect against.
Hmm. Yeah, so let's dig down a bit into, the politics behind why sort of the right have become so obsessed with this issue. Ghassan Haj, who's academic at Melbourne Uni and writes a lot on Facebook and other forums, has talked about, I'll put a link up to this piece that he's written about specifically these proposed changes to 18C in the show notes for this show, but he refers to it as a politics of white restoration. So I was wondering if you had sort of thoughts on that. Basically his thesis is that what we're particularly seeing with this sort of attack on racial discrimination legislation is a sort of anxious whiteness, that they feel that they're under attack or embattled somehow, and that things have sort of gone too far in terms of giving too much to racialized groups, and white people sort of need to take power back somehow. Is that sort of how you think of it as well?
I think I thought his argument was really interesting, and I think it's, I thought, it's a completely compelling argument about what these feelings that white people in power in Australia and internationally are kind of what they're feeling at the moment, or have been feeling for a period of time, and he kind of dates it back to Howard. I guess maybe I have a different starting question, which I'm interested in what, and maybe it's not so completely different to what Ghassan's talking about, but I guess I'm interested in what work particular words or ideas do and what effects they kind of produce. Mm. So I don't know that I can diagnose why this, what this is about. And part of me also, I'm not sure that that's, I think for Turnbull, it's also about he is bringing this in because this is what the right wing of his party has told him to do, and he's under a lot of pressure, and that's what he does, is he's continually doing what the far right wants. So I think, you know, he's also, you know, going on this kind of journey of increasing right-wingness and gaining his political capital from that, although he has incredibly declining political capital, obviously. Mm. So I think that's also part of it, and I think we can't ignore, like, political machinations and the cynical reasons why racists do what they do. But, yeah, absolutely, this is about white control. And I think, you know, he talks about a slave imaginary. And I think if we're going to be talking about Australia, we have to be talking about Aboriginal sovereignty. And we have to start our conversations, I think, with Aboriginal sovereignty and what does it mean that this is a settler colony, and how does settler colonialism perpetuate itself?
Hmm. So that's where you would see as being sort of a crucial thing that is happening through this sorts of politics is that it's also trying to, as you said, there was that case with Andrew Bolt was sort of the most well-known one, which involved Aboriginal people, and there's sort of been a number of cases since that have been mentioned that have proceeded under 18C and that have become controversial. And then you also mentioned Bill Leake recently in your comments, and he of course is the conservative is the right term, but anyway, very, very right-wing, racist and homophobic cartoonist who used to draw cartoons for The Australian, recently died and sort of become the martyr of this movement in a very creepy way. And he, of course, was most infamous for producing this very racist cartoon that was directed against Aboriginal people. So that, yeah, so maybe you can talk a bit more about how you think that it's particularly anti-Indigenous or anti-Aboriginal racism that's being contested here, or that's what's part of this debate.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, so Bill Leake drew this cartoon. I guess the most recent particularly offensive one was in the aftermath of the more widespread revelations around Don Dale and the torturing of Aboriginal kids in prison there. And his response was to draw an incredibly racist cartoon that blamed Aboriginal people and really erased colonialism and was an act of colonialism in its drawing. You know, I think there was also the case, I'm pretty sure it was at UQ, or of, you know, white kids wanting to be let into an Aboriginal computer room. Like, these are the key cases. The fact that it is Aboriginal people who mostly use this act, I think, is key. But I think, you know, on a broader level, that when white supremacy is asserting itself in Australia, it's about a denial of Aboriginal sovereignty. It's about saying that Aboriginal people belong here and can make laws here, and that the laws here are coherent, that they're useful, that they, you know, give shape to the kind of Australia that these people want us to be all living in. And so I think, you know, it's kind of on that level that we need to be prioritizing that as our frame of analysis, I think.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's really important. I guess I want to look at this also from another angle, and that is about particularly what sort of work this sorts of legislation does.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was interesting that looking back at the history of when this when these changes to the Racial Discrimination Act were enacted was in 1995 through this legislation called the Racial Hatred Legislation, I think it was called, or the Racial Hatred Act.
Mm-hmm.
And this was sort of around the time as well that there were big debates going on in the States in particular about race, about hate crime legislation and anti-vilification legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this critique that comes from the left of this sorts of legislation, and people, feminist writers like Wendy Brown have written about this. And they say that there's an issue with this sorts of, with basically sort of anti-racist social movements prioritizing this sort of legislation, because what it can do is do two things, which is one, make racism an issue of individual wrong behavior, rather than highlighting it as something structural or institutional, which was very much what the sort of original Racial Discrimination Act was aimed at, was mm-hmm. that institutional level. And then two, having this intense focus on the state as needing to have this legislation to govern people's behaviour makes the state into this potential protective, benevolent agent, rather than seeing it, you know, sort of as a barrier to, or in fact, institutor of racial discrimination and sort of structural racial violence. And I think that that's pretty interesting to link into your point about talking about Aboriginal sovereignty. So I was wondering what you think the place of that sort of critique is in this debate. Is it something that we need to be mindful of, or has the way that this debate played out in Australia really made that sort of critique not so relevant?
I mean, I think one of the things I think about when I'm thinking about getting restitution or getting the state to do something for us is Hannah Arendt writes about the Nuremberg trials, and to very much paraphrase, her basic point is, the point she makes about them is, they're completely insufficient but completely necessary.
Mm.
And I really, when I read that, that really clicked for me. And I think it's really true. And I think it's the same is true with this, and really, I guess, with any liberal reform. I'm not a liberal, so I don't ever think liberal answers are going to provide the kind of world that we should be living in. But at the same time, sometimes these are things that also need to happen, as well as, but they're not the answer. So I don't think hate speech should be allowed. At the same time, I don't believe that in the police force as a force for governing things, nor do I hold much faith in courts or think that court remedies are useful. So I think we need to kind of hold that contradiction and say yes, but to all of it. So I guess to me that's kind of it. You know, I agree that we can't be thinking about individual it as an individual problem or as a problem of just the interpersonal, but it is also about the interpersonal. It is also about those individual interactions. But I guess it's also about, we need a huge reframing we're never going to find liberation in the liberal state, right? So we need to be thinking differently. And I guess part of it is also thinking about, like, who is this all directed at? Who is, you know, when are we trying to talk to white people who never face this kind of racism? Mm. And when are we trying to educate them, and when are we trying to get them to change their behaviour? And when are we saying, who cares about the white people, who cares about the Anglos? Like, those of us who aren't Anglo, those people, you know, like, let's just have our own world that doesn't involve them. And to me, that's the much more interesting thing, is how can we do something that effaces white Australia?
Mm. Well, yeah, I definitely want to get into that in terms of what sort of the response of racialized people and people of color has been to this, and then what also the more sort of official multicultural bodies have what their response has been. So I think that's some really interesting stuff to talk about. But I kind of wanted to also, before we get there, I wanted to talk a bit about the particularly like a Jewish perspective on this issue. And one thing that I don't know if it was reported that much in the news, but there's a major new exhibition, the permanent Holocaust exhibition that's been opened at the Sydney Jewish Museum. And it was opened by Malcolm Turnbull. And it was opened the day before the coalition announced that they were going to make these changes, or attempt to make these changes to 18C. And I'll put the speech up in the show notes, but you and I both had a read through it. And I think it's Malcolm Turnbull, even recently, has, you know, come out and said, condemned Pauline Hanson for, proposing her Muslim ban, and said that's counterproductive. But at the same time, is very happy to say, Bill Leak was, you know, this great hero, and he shouldn't have been condemned for writing a cartoon. So he's walking this really, he has a very particular brand of multiculturalism. I totally think that he is, you know, he sincerely believes in his version of multiculturalism. But yeah, so I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about that, because he, in his speech opening this exhibit, he said, that the Holocaust must never happen again. It's a danger of racism in societies that's still a threat. Australia's a very successful multicultural country. And we have to, you know, defend that or be proud of it. Yeah. So how are these things happening all at the same time?
Yeah, I think it's super interesting. And I think that also is just a small side note. I mean, we've also saw like Susan Rutland, who's, quite a big name professor of Jewish history in Australia, for international guests who don't know her, also wrote an article talking about how Bill Leak was wonderful and how they really bonded. So I think...
I saw that.
Yeah. So I think, you know, there's all sorts of contradictions, seeming contradictions that go on that people make. And I think what's incredible about Turnbull's speech, and I highly encourage everybody to read it, is that it starts off in a way that, like, I mean, it could be the left talking, and maybe this says a lot about where the left is at as well, that, you know, he starts off by saying, let me talk to you about the banality of evil, let me talk to you about, like, these bureaucrats who sit around and calmly and methodically work out how best to, and most efficiently to kill 6 million people. That last bit's a quote from his speech. He says that we should not assume ever that the Holocaust was one break in reality, one act of insanity that could never be repeated again. Like, any of us could do it. We're all capable of the greatest love, he says, but we're capable of terrible crimes. And what's so kind of fantastical about that is that that's what we're saying about Turnbull and his government. Like, this is what we say about Dutton and Morrison and the way they treat refugees and the way they treat Aboriginal people and the way they're treating any kind of racialized group of people, the way they treat women, is we say, like, this is all part of it. that this is the, you know, people, the bureaucrats who are doing this kind of potentially evil work or actually evil work. Mm. So, I mean, there's kind of, I think we're all capable of this amazing projection where we think it's not us who are doing this evil, right? And
yeah.
we think it's other people. And I think Turnbull is being sincere. I mean, you know, I obviously don't know him and have never met him, but I don't think this is a cynical speech. I think he really believes that the Holocaust was this terrible thing and that anybody would be capable of it, but also not him, right?
Yeah.
And that's what we all love to think, is that it's never going to be us. We're going to be, the worst we would ever be is the bystanders. We would never be the perpetrators. And I think that's a really dangerous thought for any of us to get into, and what makes so clear that we all need to be so reflexive with our ethics and thinking about how we interact in the world. Yeah, I think, you know, Turnbull is giving this speech where he talks about Jews as, you know, a type of model minority within Australia, and talks about the contributions that we've made to Australia. Talks about John Monash, you know, Australian general, Australian Jewish military general, and credits Monash with, you know, having won the First World War. Yeah. yeah, you know, and it's I gave a paper once at a history museum, sorry, history conference in Australia, in Melbourne, years ago, and the first question I got was, you know, I was talking about Holocaust memory, and the first question I got was, what do I think about John Monash?
Right.
Like, the connection between Monash and the Jews is so entrenched and so weird in this country.
Yeah, I think, and I mean, the interesting thing is that he talks about Monash and he says he was weird because he was a Jewish soldier.
Yeah.
And then he says because Jewish soldiers didn't exist, and he gives this very sort of cliched Holocaust narrative, which you've examined in great detail in your book, which is the Jews were defenseless before. They were an abnormal people. They didn't have a state. They didn't have guns. They were sort of feminized victims before the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
And now that we have Israel, we have, you know, Jews with guns, are normal people. And if, and he all but says if Israel it had existed, then the Holocaust wouldn't have happened. Can you tell us a bit about, that's narrative?
I mean, one of the first things to start with is that, so Sandy Gilman writes about Jews, the Jewish body, and talks about how in, I think it's in 19th century Western Europe, Jews were imagined as having flat feet. There was an idea that non-Jews had about the Jewish body, that all Jews had flat feet and hence could not walk properly and hence could not be soldiers. So they were not allowed into the army. And so they were not a fit part of the body politic in a very real body politic way. So I think that's a really interesting idea, that the Jewish body is not capable. Not that I'm saying Jews should want to be in an army and should be thought of as being soldiers, but, you know, this is where these kinds of ideas come from, is as you're saying, this kind of, it's a feminization and it's a idea of the decrepit Jewish body. And so Turnbull totally buys into that narrative and into this idea that, yes, we have redemption through a Jewish nation state. It's this idea of, you know, this is the happy ending to the story of the Holocaust, that so many teachers of the Holocaust talk about, so many narratives of the Holocaust end with the creation of Israel, because it's redemption, it's happiness, it's okay, we're going to be okay in the future. And it's a key reason why Zionism becomes so dominant in Jewish communities, because it's seen that if you don't support a Jewish state, then you think that the Jews aren't capable. You think that Jews shouldn't have self-determination. It's a very narrow idea of what self-determination is and what Jews should aspire to be. And it's incredibly assimilationist.
Yeah. I think that, and the, I mean, the interesting thing is we were talking a bit before this interview about I was at the Jewish Studies Conference, and the curator of this exhibition gave quite a substantial speech, and then we got a little preview of the exhibition. And the interesting thing about this exhibition is precisely that they've consciously tried to avoid that redemptive narrative in ending the Holocaust in Israel, but also in ending the Holocaust in Australia, and having Australia as being, you know, this great democracy where racism mm-hmm. doesn't exist, and, you know, it's a place for flourishing and et cetera, yeah. which was also a key part of some dominant ways of narrating the Holocaust.
Yep.
So we have this like thing where actually the sort of official, the curator and the exhibition itself is actually quite at odds with the yeah. picture that Turnbull is painting. And
yeah.
I thought it was interesting, yeah, that Turnbull, like, to think about why that narrative of the Holocaust and Israel and sort of this inextricability of Jews and Israel is a really comfortable narrative for Turnbull's version of multiculturalism. Mm-hmm. Because I think it plays into this sort of dominant way of doing white multiculturalism, which is Ghassan Hajj's yep. term, which is that it's a way of managing difference. It's a way of Anglos or white people having these sort of very recognisable, stable and coherent sort of ethnic bodies that are out there that can be governed and can be managed in just the right way. And I think that is how a key part of how Jews fit into that sort of version of liberal multiculturalism is precisely through saying, well, Jews don't necessarily have an interest in critiquing racism or being sort of on side with maybe with Aboriginal sovereignty or those sorts of issues or being active or disruptive. What their key thing is Israel. And that's how we can acknowledge their grievances, make sure that as long as we say that, you know, policies in Israel are all right, then that's how we can understand and interact with sort of the Jewish community as it's politically constituted in Australia.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think the other key part of it is the way that he uses Jews and he uses the Holocaust as a way to build Australian national identity. So in his speech, yeah. he talks about, you know, talks about Australia living in remarkable harmony with people from all over the world, with every religion, with all the languages. He kind of ends by talking about giving a story of two Holocaust survivors that he used to live near, and then ends by talking about, you know, a foundation of mutual respect, and this is what makes Australia the great multicultural society that it is. So I think it's totally about management, and I think it's also mm-hmm. about creating like an affective community, a community that bonds together with a set of emotions around Australia as being great, and because that's something to be proud of and something to feel mm. sad about if something lapses. But it's almost, we don't need 18C to bring it back to that, because we are this great multicultural society. And how could you suggest that we're not? Of course we are. What, you know, there's no racism. We are proud of this multiculturalism. And so, yeah, it's a form of management of people and of ideas and of emotions, I think.
Yeah, totally. So I want to, yeah, now get into sort of like the pushback yeah. to these proposed changes. And two different things that kind of emerged. One was the hashtag started by the writer Benjamin Law on Twitter, mm-hmm. Which was hashtag freedom of speech. And this was kind of this really moving stories that people shared using this hashtag, basically about them being racially abused or discriminated against in different ways in Australia, and the real hurt that that's caused. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I saw on Twitter that led me to write that like short post that I wrote on Facebook the other day was the kinds of sharing of these stories and the kinds of ways in which people were expressing the sense of what is created and what is made possible by this racism. And so we use this hashtag about freedom of speech because so often people on the right and incredibly annoyingly people who think they're on the left frame this as a question of freedom of speech, and it's nothing to do with freedom of speech. Firstly, because the freedom of speech just isn't such a big issue in Australia and it's such a weird debate to import to this country, but also because it's just not the question of what's happening and we just know that, right? Like with so many reasons why we know that's not what it's about. But, you know, as one example, you know, that there are so many other actual issues of breaches of freedom of speech that some people don't care about, you know, the Border Force Act, which prevents doctors talking about what's being done to refugees and the hurt that's being done. You know, there's so many examples around whistleblower laws, around whatever. Anyway, the point is it's not about freedom of speech. So it was an interesting kind of twist on that he chose that as the hashtag. And I think that was a really lovely way of flipping it and of saying this isn't about freedom of speech and this is the effect of your conversations and you're framing it as freedom of speech is all these things continue to happen and people carry these kinds of events within their memories and histories and they all need to be talked about. And they need to be publicly shared. And I think there's something incredibly powerful in the public sharing of them in a way that's about the people who are subjected to them, to these moments, forming community around that sharing.
Yeah, totally. I think, I'll put a link up to maybe the a collation of some of these tweets in the show notes. The other thing I wanted to talk about, was the sort of official multicultural, I don't know if official is the right term, but basically, you know, there was this new body that's was launched, which is sort of a coalition of sort of ethnic peak bodies called the Coalition to Advance Multiculturalism. And as you say, you know, this debate's been going on for over 18C for in a particularly heightened way for the last few years, particularly since the Andrew Bolt case. And it's really been this kind of, it's been an interesting to watch the official ethnic bodies really unite around this issue, which is not something actually that happens very often in Australian politics. Cara, I wonder if you had some thoughts about that. And then I also had some thought, I also was wondering if you would want to comment about that, the sort of place that Jews have had in, I guess, leading or being the most prominent, some of the most prominent voices in challenging the government's agenda here.
I mean, I think it's wonderful when different groups can come together around this. I think it's always a shame when we come together to face something that's negative. But yeah, I think it kind of reveals the extent of racial discrimination in this country, that it does unite people who do so regularly disagree and do oftentimes struggle to come together. So I guess it tells us something about the depth of what's going on. That's really interesting, and I guess, you know, there's always going to be limits to coalitions, and you know, one's forced to wonder of where does this coalition go and how does it last and is it capabilities to do something quite limited, and is it going to be limited to putting out statements and holding press conferences and those kinds of things, which is valuable, but I guess it's, you know, it's not going to be a press conference that's going to change the world. But I think that kind of united pressure is wonderful and not to be sneered at. And I think, yeah, I think it's interesting that Jews have played such a prominent role in this, I guess. And I guess maybe it is this kind of really very real history and knowledge and memory of the depths of what this racism can do, that we know that hate speech can progress to become other things. We know that it is already violence. We know, you know, what damage words do, and we also know that if people work together, they can change things. And, you know, we might not think that Israel is the good resolution, and we might be opposed to a lot about Israel and a lot about what Zionists, you know, or almost everything Zionists work for.
Mm.
But you can't deny that it's been an effective political movement, right? Mm. So I think there is maybe a lesson there of that some people, yeah, that there is kind of knowledge of how to affect change, maybe.
I wonder if yeah, I think that gets to a couple of different issues, which is sort of, is there a problem that sort of the sort of only opportunities for this sort of coalition building seem to be really defensive maneuver? And is that part of the issue that we've kind of lost that it's sort of like a real politics of sort of like a fighting multiculturalism, I want to say, or like a real challenging multiculturalism sort of don't really exist? And I guess, I don't know, yeah, part of that seems to me to be to do with the history of multiculturalism in Australia being very, you know, hard fought for and won, but by particularly Jewish groups and sort of Southern European groups for the most part, sort of driving a lot of those sort of initial structural changes. And then is there like a you know, sometimes like a bit of a clash where you have sort of these older ethnic groups who are very invested in the language of multiculturalism, but maybe more groups that have come here sort of in the last 30, 40 years, that isn't quite the right language, or that the issues are not being addressed through this, those sort of established multicultural structures?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously the multiculturalism that we have in Australia is incredibly flimsy and is really, you know, about like food and dances and that kind of thing, and doesn't it's, you know, when Turnbull can say his pro-multiculturalism and use that kind of nation building language, like it's a form of nation building, and I think that's really important to remember, is that it's about making Australia a better place and all of us multicultural types fitting in to help Australia be better. I've been reading a lot of Melanie K. Kantrovitz recently. I mean, I'm always reading her and learning from her, but for a couple of different writing projects that I'm doing, I returned to a particular section of her book, The Colours of Jews, which, listeners, if you haven't read it, what are you doing? Get a copy right now and read that thing. But one of the
I'll put a link up.
Yeah, excellent. So I mean, it's changed my world, this book. But one of the things that I sort of came back to the other day was, she has this formulation where she talks about solidarity as the political version of love, and she says it's the book's in large part about, so it's about racism, it's about what an actual substantial multiculturalism might be. It's about Jewish history and memory and Jewishness it's a lot about race and racialization. And so she's kind of talking about diasporas, and she's putting forward a diasporas program where, you know, it's about not diasporas in like this one homeland that we're all dispersed from, but about like networks and people living in transnational community and that kind of thing. And I think it's an incredibly powerful idea. But she talks about that we should, the diaspora value solidarity, not as a necessary evil. So I'm quoting here, not solely because as we confront the most powerful machine of war and capital the world has ever known, we understand that solidarity is our only power. Diaspora, she writes, choose solidarity as the highest expression of humanity. And I find that an incredibly compelling version of what multiculturalism could look like, or of what political community could look like. That, yeah, that it's not about how do we consume each other. It's not about an extractive model of multiculturalism or an accumulation model of multiculturalism, where we're interacting with each other in order to acquire something, whether it's a positive sense of Australia or a nice meal or, you know, an interesting experience, or even really a new idea. It's about a version of love. It's about recognise each other's humanity and recognising a sense of profound togetherness. To me, that's the kind of multiculturalism that could change things.
Mm. Totally. I think, yeah, to sort of bring it back to also, yeah, our discussion about Aboriginal sovereignty and how that fits with these discussions of multiculturalism. I was really taken recently by this story. I'll put a link up to this as well, but of the formation of Migrants for Aboriginal Rights around the time of the Bicentennial, which is, of course, the Bicentennial of the landing of the First Fleet in 1988, where there were all these official Australian nationalistic celebrations, including, very offensive reenactments. And it was this thing, and what was interesting about it was that it was very much the Australian government had all this money that was assigned for having this big celebration, and they wanted to give money to ethnic and multicultural groups to, you know, invest in like, theatre pieces or artistic expressions or costumes or whatever, and participate in their sort of official bicentennial celebrations. And this is the particular story of sort of more left-leaning groups in the Italian community, and that they were sort of had these two options, basically, where they could either, one, take this money and participate in this official celebrations, and then, two, they were approached by these Aboriginal activist groups who organised a massive, nationwide demonstration at this time, and they were approached by them and said, you know, don't take the money, join with us. And that's exactly what they did. They refused to join in these official multicultural celebrations, and instead formed with all these other migrant groups, the Migrant for Aboriginal Rights, and they joined in with the Aboriginal rally instead.
And
I think that to me was sort of like this thing that I keep thinking about of a model of how to practice a multiculturalism. That's sort of against the state and that's in solidarity with Indigenous people. And, that's sort of something that I continue to sort of think about in reference to these issues too. Yeah,
I totally agree. I mean, I think it's about this kind of I think for me, I keep coming back to this idea of forgetting. You know, Turnbull's speech is only possible because he actively forgets that he is, you know, a perpetrator of dispossession of Aboriginal people. You know, these kinds of claims about Australian multiculturalism are only possible if you forget Aboriginal people, if you forget that it's their land and that we're on their land, those of us who aren't Aboriginal. And I think, those moments where, like, we need to be led in our struggles by Aboriginal people. Any moment when we're not, you know, I think that's an error, and I think it's an anti-solidarity that's disastrous, I think. And yeah, I agree with you that that's kind of key to how we need to be responding to these things and what we need to be keeping in mind when, as we're saying, 18C needs to be retained. And I do think 18C needs to be retained. And I do think that, that this, what the government's doing is terrible and needs to be opposed. At the same time, we need to be doing all these other things that are actually going to create substantive change and move us towards some kind of decolonization.
That's great. I think to finish off, do you have any sort of, ideas or sort of practical campaigns or things that people should maybe, if they're in Australia or maybe internationally as well, sort of look into in terms of that? And any sort of final thoughts?
Sure. I mean, I guess the first place to start would be look up Warriors of the Aboriginal Resistance if you're not already familiar with them. Check them out on Facebook. When they organise protests, go to their protests. Find other Aboriginal writers and speakers. I'm going to put in a plug for my friend Crystal McKinnon. Read everything she writes. I think reading and citation's important when you're reading stuff, don't read stuff by white people. In particular, don't read anything by white men, right? And also, just don't listen to what white men are saying about 18C. You know, it's just, even when they're on the left, they're just kind of a bit annoying. hashtag not all men, lol. I think, those kinds of things. I mean, I'm a historian, I'm an academic, so obviously I want people to, read more, and that's the way I learn and that's the way I think. So I think reading is important, but I think conversations are really important. I think oftentimes it's about shutting up and listening, and then that's kind of more of what I try to do, is listen to other people and learn from other people who I respect. So seek those people out and don't ask them for something, but listen to them when they're speaking. I guess get involved internationally. If you're only doing stuff in Australia or only doing stuff in whatever country you're in, then you're doing it wrong. Reach out across the borders. That's how we tear them down. Find ways to do solidarity work that crosses the oceans and the borders, and take it seriously. Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, I think this has been really interesting conversation, and I think we've covered a lot of important ground. So thanks very much for being on the program with us, Geordie, and we definitely hope to have you on again.
Thanks so much, Max.
Okay. So thanks very much again, Geordie, for that really interesting conversation. I'm sure we'll have Geordie on the program again very soon. So the shout out for today is to a piece called Notes on Late Fascism by Alberto Toscano, who is a philosopher and academic at Goldsmiths in London. It's quite a dense piece, so perhaps not for the faint of heart, but it's definitely something you can sink your teeth into. It's an interesting reassessment of 20th century analyses of fascism, which looks at them for insight into how we can understand the particular variants of far-right politics seemingly in ascendancy today, including Trumpism, Le Pen, etc. Rather than plumbing these analyses by thinkers such as Adorno, Sartre, and Bloch for hidden clues or connections which prove that post-fascism is really exactly the same as 20th century fascism, Toscano uses the insights of these thinkers to outline today's political conjuncture as a very different to the first half of the 20th century, and thus productive of new variants of fascist politics. I think one strength of this piece is its skewering of this new trope of the white working class, the forgotten or left behind people who are supposedly the basis of support for the new far right. Toscano suggests this is a pseudo-reactionary type of class politics that is very different from a political class consciousness. I think this piece also ties in with the next episode of Mazel Tov Cocktail, where I talk to a German activist about how historical analyses of fascism are informing current left politics in Germany. Anyway, without going into too much detail, have a read, and we'll see you next time on Mazel Tov Cocktail. Music in this episode came from the Eastern Watershed Klezmer Quartet.